Lecture 50, Poverty and Welfare Programs.
The last few lectures have been discussing things that could go wrong in markets for goods. Problems of competition, antitrust, anti-competitive practices, pollution, technology, and public goods. With this lecture, we shift the focus a little bit and begin to talk about problems that can arise in labor markets, specifically problems that can arise when some people end up poor and other people end up rich. A market economy uses supply and demand to set prices, wages, and interest rates. It doesn't make any intrinsic judgments about the worth or the fairness or the justice of these outcomes. In such an economy, in the labor market, there are always going to be some people who are unlucky or disadvantaged or disabled or even just plain lazy, who end up with lower income. Conversely, there will be some people who are lucky or advantaged or talented or just extremely hard workers who will end up with additional income or additional resources. A market can easily create great wealth for some while leaving others in poverty. This lecture focuses on the issue of poverty and the government welfare programs that seek to address poverty. The next lecture then looks at the issue of inequality of incomes, which covers the entire range of the income distribution, not just those with low incomes. The starting point for discussing poverty is that we have to define what we mean by being in poverty. What do we mean by the poverty line or the poverty rate? And to get you sort of in the mental spirit for this, I have to take you back to the early 1960s, when Michael Harrington has just published his famous book, The Other America, which offers a vivid portraits of what it really meant to be poor. The idea of poverty is very much on the public agenda in a way it really hadn't been before. But government didn't have any official definition of poverty, and there was no clear sense in a policy terms of what it would take to lift people out of poverty. The working definition of poverty in 1963 was that poverty was any household with less than $3,000 in income. But there were no adjustments for, say, the number of children, or whether it was one-parent or two-parent family, and there was no really deep justification for that $3,000 figure, except that it was sort of a nice round number. Well, a woman named Molly Arshansky was working for the Social Security Administration, and she was transferred over to the department which was given the job of defining what poverty was going to be. And she based her definition on two ideas. The first one was, how much did it cost to buy a basic diet? And since that cost of buying a basic diet would vary according to the size of family, then there would be an automatically built-in adjustment for different family sizes. The second notion was that food was one-third of the family budget. So Molly Arshansky is working in the Social Security Administration. And remember, Social Security is responsible for survivor's benefits. Survivor's benefits sort of get you into the issue of poverty and what you're going to pay people who are surviving after a spouse has died. Arshansky had previously worked in the Department of Agriculture, where they put together food plans for how much it cost to feed families of different sizes. And the Department of Agriculture had various plans for what it would cost to buy a basic diet ranked by level of spending. They sort of had a high-cost plan, a medium-cost plan, a low-cost plan, and what they called the economy plan was the cheapest plan for how much it would cost to give a family a nutritionally adequate diet. So Arshansky's idea was to link this concept of poverty she was being asked to define to something concrete, like food. She said in an interview later when she was asked about this, "I wanted to show what it was like to not have enough money. It's not just that the poor had less money, they didn't have enough. I knew you couldn't spend for one necessity without taking away from another." So Arshansky looked at this economy food plan. And she figured out what the economy food plan would cost for 62 different family types, depending on age, number of children, whether it was a single parent or a two-parent family. She looked at the economy plan for feeding all 62 different groups. And she also looked back at a 1955 study, which said that the average family spends about one-third of its income on food. She also did a separate set of calculations for farm families to take into account that they could produce a certain amount of their own food. So, she went to the Census Bureau with these numbers. She had what it would cost to buy an adequate diet for these 62 different groups, and then multiplying that by 3, since one-third of what you were spending out of your income was food, she said, that'll be my poverty line. And she went to the Census Bureau and said, okay, here's my income numbers. How many people are below the poverty line? Now, to give you a sense of the state of play at this time, at that point, the Census Bureau had actually, they had published breakdowns of income by family size, but they had never before broken down income taking number of parents or gender of head of household or age of the children into account. And it actually cost them about $2,500, which is close to the poverty level income for a year, to find out how many people were below Orshansky's poverty line. And they found out that in that year, by that poverty line, about 20 million children were living in households that were below the poverty line. Now, this general way of looking at what the poverty line meant spread very, very fast. It was being used in prominent government reports as early as 1964, and by 1969, it actually became the official definition of the poverty line. And ever since then, the poverty line has remained basically the same as what Orshansky defined back in the early 1960s. Now, there have been some minor changes. The separate poverty lines for farm households and for female-headed households were abolished in 1981, and Orshansky's original poverty line went up to 7 children. It's now been expanded up to 9 children. Orshansky liked to emphasize when she talked about the poverty line that the actual amounts in the poverty line were really not a heck of a lot of money. And she would do sort of simple, long division to show that. Let me give you a modern example. In 2003, the poverty line for a family of 4 with 2 parents and 2 kids is $18,660. Now, let's say that they spend one-third of that on food, Orshansky's assumption. So that's $6,220 a year for food. With 365 days in a year, that's about $17 per day. With 3 meals per day and 4 people at each meal, that's an average of $1.42 per meal for the entire year. That's not what you would call an exorbitant standard of living. Now, any measure of poverty, including this one, will be subject to a range of potential criticisms. Let me give you some of the criticisms that have been raised about Orshansky's line. What's going on, for example, with this multiple that households spend one-third of their income on food? I mean, that was a study from the mid-1950s. By later in the 1960s, the average household was spending something like a quarter of income on food, and now it's more like a fifth of income on food. The share of income being spent on food has gradually declined over time. But we haven't sort of raised the multiple and taken the food expenses, and instead of multiplying by 3, multiplied them by 4 or by 5. Why use the economy food plan? Actually, if you look in the documents of the time, the economy food plan was supposed to be for emergencies, like what you could really just barely scrape by with. Why not use the low-cost food plan or the moderate food plan that would be a little bit more reasonable in terms of what people actually spent on food? The poverty line that Orshansky set is increased each year for inflation. So it does rise with inflation over time. But should it also be increased to reflect economic growth and the fact that we're living in a richer society? After all, some part of our idea of what poverty means is relative to the other people in society. And so just increasing for inflation but not for economic growth doesn't take into account that relative feeling. Should the poverty line take modern technology into account? Should poor people have enough money to have access to cable TV or cell phones or broadband internet access at home? What about geographic disparity? Shouldn't the poverty level be a higher number in a high-income state like California or New York and a lower number in a lower-income state like Arkansas or South Dakota? The poverty line is measured on before-tax income. Should it take other factors into account? For example, if you get government benefits like Medicaid or food stamps, should those be added to your income when you're thinking about whether you're poor or not? What about help provided through the tax code, through tax credits, like this earned income tax credit we'll talk about later on in this lecture? That's not included because it's after tax benefits, not before tax. Should a working poor family that doesn't have health insurance be viewed as having less income than a working poor family that does have health insurance, even if their income at the end of the year looks just the same? There was a National Academy of Sciences panels in the mid-1990s which looked at how poverty is defined, and their suggestion was that rather than basing it just on food, you should set the poverty line by looking at what the average household spends on a combination of food, clothing, and shelter, and then taking some percentage of that. So you would still link the idea of poverty to what it costs to buy basic necessities, but you would link it sort of in a relative way. That is, what the average person was buying would pull up what the poverty line was. Now, there's a lot of interesting philosophical things to think about what alternate poverty lines might make sense. And in fact, the Census Bureau publishes what the poverty rate would be if you use different kinds of definitions. But, you know, it's really, 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 really useful to have a single poverty line over time, not to be changing the definition every year. Because if you change the definition every year, you don't know whether the poverty rate changed because of the definitional change or because of actual poverty changing. If you leave the definition alone, or mostly alone, you can at least be pretty confident that changes in the poverty rate are telling you something about what happened in the economy. So, the U.S. poverty rate is the percentage of people in the U.S. population who are below Orshansky's poverty line. It's been projected back into the 1950s and measured each year by the Census Bureau. If you look at those numbers over time, the poverty rate in 1960 would have been about 22.2%. That's the share of the U.S. population that would have been below the poverty line. However, that drops dramatically during the rapid economic growth of the 1960s. And by 1969, the poverty rate is down to only 12.1%. By 1973, it's down to 11.1%. So an enormous number of people sort of move above Orshansky's policy line or poverty line over that time. But during the bad economy of the 1970s, big recessions, high inflation, by 1982, the poverty rate is back up to about 15%. And in 1993, although it's fluctuated up and down a little bit, it's still about 15%. During the strong economic growth of the late 1990s, the poverty rate begins to sag down again. And by 2004, it's bounced up a little, but it's about 12.4%. Another way to say that in broad terms is there's a sharp decline in the poverty rate during the 1960s and perhaps into the early 1970s. But since then, the poverty rate really has not changed a heck of a lot. It's sort of been in that range of 15% in bad years with recessions, maybe 12% in good years when the economy's been growing for a while. However, the composition of who is poor has shifted over recent decades. It used to be that if you looked at who are the poor people, back in about 1960 or 1970, you could say in some ways, if you had to describe the poor in a word, you would say it's the elderly. Because the elderly were disproportionately poor. But today, with help from Social Security and with help from Medicare and other programs for the elderly, it's no longer true that the poverty rate for the elderly is higher than the poverty rate for the rest of the population. For a while now, it's been true that if you want the group which is disproportionately poor, it's single mother families with children. My immediate reaction to the existence of poverty in a country as rich as the United States is to support government programs to assist the poor. My second reaction is still to give assistance, but also to give some careful thought as to how that assistance is provided and what incentives are involved. And sometimes when I'm thinking about this problem of incentives, I go back to this old statement. Give a man a fish and he'll eat for a day, but teach him how to fish and he'll eat forever. I don't know who actually said that. Some websites say it's a Chinese proverb, but as far as I know, that might actually be from China or it might be from a fortune cookie. But I would argue that when you're thinking about poverty, that statement contains both a great truth and a great dilemma. Now, here's the great truth. It's better if people can earn their living than if they just keep getting handouts. Better to teach them to fish than just give them fish. And here's the great dilemma, or what my old philosophy professors used to call a tension. There's a tension between giving people immediate assistance and helping them learn how to help themselves. What is the man supposed to eat while you're teaching him to fish? I mean, it's nice to teach him how to fish, but it's going to take him a while to learn. You're going to need to give him fish for a while he's learning. But if you're giving him fish all the time, why is he going to bother to learn to fish? Why won't he just take the fish and not bother trying to learn? Every method of trying to help those with low incomes runs into this fundamental tension, and there's really no way out of it. If you don't help the poor in a wealthy society, it seems cruel and immoral. But if you do help the poor, you will reduce, at least to some extent, their incentive to support themselves. The social safety net shouldn't be a hammock, shouldn't be something which is hard to climb into and hard to climb out of. Instead, the social safety net should be like that kind of net that's used in circuses to catch trapeze artists. You sort of fall into it and it's soft, but then you bounce up and out again and go back into the real world and into a regular life where you're supporting yourself. Now, there's no way, I think, to avoid this problem altogether of the tension between helping people and reducing their incentives to support themselves. But you can set up programs so this conflict is either relatively large or relatively small. And that's where we get into these issues of incentives. So, to consider the fundamental problem, let's consider a basic proposal. The U.S. government guarantees people will receive the poverty level of income. I just guarantee that. So, family of four in 2003, like we said before, will get $18,660. If you earn less than that amount, the government will give you enough money to bring you up to that level, up to that $18,660. Now, what could be wrong with this proposal, other than, you know, maybe not being generous enough? But in terms of incentives, what could be wrong with it? Well, let's think about the incentives for a moment. If the family works zero, total income is $18,660, all from the government. Now, imagine one parent gets a full-time job, but it's a low-wage job. They work 2,000 hours during the year. That would be 50 weeks of 40-hour weeks. They earn $6 an hour. So 2,000 hours, $6 an hour, they earn $12,000. And in reward, their reward for going out and earning those $12,000 is that total family income is, you got it, exactly the same. $18,660, because the government tops you up to the poverty line no matter how much you earn. Now, imagine the second parent gets a half-time job and earns an additional $6,000 a year. So now total family earnings are $18,000. And total family income is, you got it, $18,660. You're topped up to the poverty line if you're below it. If both parents worked full-time and they each earned $12,000 a year, then the total family income could be $24,000 a year, and they would be above the poverty line. But think about this for a moment. Now, they're working a total of $4,000 a year, and their total gain in income is only about $5,400 over not working at all. Because not working at all, they would have gotten the $18,660. At an hourly rate, their gain from working is only about $1.30 an hour. And if they're both working full-time, they probably have extra expenses for childcare and transportation. They're going to owe taxes. It's not clear they're going to come out ahead at all. The fundamental problem here is called, by economists, a negative income tax. And a negative income tax arises when the government reduces your welfare benefits as the recipient earns additional income. So, let's think about how a negative income tax happens. A regular positive income tax, where you earn money and the government takes part of the money, that's the tax most people are familiar with. With a negative income tax, when you earn money, the government reduces your benefits. But both kinds of taxes affect the incentive to work. A positive income tax can discourage you from working by reducing how much your take-home pay is, and removing benefits as you work also reduces the gain you get from working. The example I just gave a moment ago is a negative income tax which is set at 100%. That is, every time that family earned a dollar, they lost a dollar in government benefits. So the negative income tax was 100%. The offset was 100%. When the negative income tax gets very high, especially 100%, there's what economists call a poverty trap. For that family, there is no incentive to take a low-paying job. There is no incentive to sort of take that starting point on the employment ladder where maybe you could get promoted and get experience, because you literally get zero gain from working. Now, you might at this point say something like the following. Well, you know, Tim, this is really interesting in a hypothetical sort of way, but no moron would ever set up a welfare system that offered no reward at all for working. That would be stupid beyond belief. So, how about a realistic view of what's happening in these government welfare programs? And here's the bad news. Actually, that 100% negative income tax is a completely accurate description of how the main welfare program, called Aid to Families with Dependent Children, worked through the 1960s and 70s and into the 1980s in most states. That is, every time you earned a dollar, the government took away a dollar in welfare benefits. In fact, it's even worse than that, because there are other welfare programs like food stamps and Medicaid. So when you worked or thought about earning a dollar of income, you not only lost a dollar of AFDC or welfare benefits, but you could also lose some food stamps and some eligibility for Medicaid. And you don't get to keep the whole dollar you earned anyway because of the positive taxes you owe on it. So if you think 100% negative income tax is crazy and a terrible poverty trap, well, the negative income tax of like 120% or 140% is even crazier. And if you understand that argument, you are giving a standard critique that economists gave of the U.S. system for helping those with low incomes, as it existed from at least the mid-1960s up into the early 1980s. Now, government has a range of policies available that seek to reduce the negative income tax and address this poverty trap problem. One choice, for example, is phase out the welfare payments more slowly. Reduce the rate at which the welfare payments are phased out as someone earns income. In 1996, there was a big Welfare Reform Act, and the old aid to families with dependent children was changed to a new program called TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families. And under that program, although this varies state by state, it's now common that there's a 50% reduction in TANF benefits for each dollar earned. Again, it differs some state by state. Some states even have rules that you can earn a certain amount without having your benefits reduced at all, or you don't have your benefits reduced if you marry someone who is working. So there's a lot of different state rules. But the point is, the 100% negative income tax is pretty much gone away. It's still 50%, which is pretty high, but it's not 100%. Another option, the earned income tax credit, is a provision of the tax code that gives low-income families additional income when they earn money. And that helps to offset the withdrawal of other government benefits. Works like this, and this is sort of an example based on a family with two children in 2004. As you start off earning income, up to $10,510 is what it was, you get an extra 40% back in a tax credit. So if you were earning $10,510, that 40% means you'd get $4,202 extra. Then, as you increase your earnings from $10,510 up to $13,710, you're earning more money, but there's no reduction in that $42,002 you were getting. Above that level, they start phasing out the money. So every additional dollar you earned loses 26 cents of the tax credit money. Now, the point is that work is subsidized for low-income workers. Now, of course, it does phase out. It does have a negative income tax part as it phases out, but, I mean, you have to phase it out somehow. It's interesting that the amount of money that is paid out through this earned income tax credit in 2004 was about $34 billion a year, and that was actually worth more than the welfare payments for the country in that year, which were only about $24 billion. For some programs like Medicaid, which pays for medical care for poor families with children, various states have changed the rules so that as you get above the poverty line, you can keep getting Medicaid up to like two times the poverty line. So the incentive to work and get that job that gets you started in the labor market is not removed. The big trick here, though, the big question is, don't force poor people to choose between working in a job with no health benefits and losing Medicaid and losing health insurance for their children. Another way in which we've tried to get around the problem of these negative work incentives is through work requirements. Starting in the late 1980s and up into the mid-1990s, there were a series of welfare reforms passed by individual states that required welfare recipients to go back to work fairly quickly. In 1996, that big welfare reform bill I mentioned before said that this is now federal law, that all the states had to have basic rules to get federal money. They needed to get a certain percentage of their welfare recipients back to work. You had to be, I think it was 25% of welfare recipients had to be in a work-related activity in 1997, and then that was going to raise 5% a year until 50% of the recipients were in a work-related activity by 2002. Now, a work-related activity could be a job, either a public sector, a private sector job. It could be on-the-job training. States had a lot of ability to define what it meant to be in a job-related activity. And there was a two-year cutoff. You had to get that work started after no more than 2 years of welfare benefits. You had a lifetime limit of 5 years. So there had been about 14 million recipients a month of the old AFDC welfare program back in 1994. And remember, the economy was doing pretty well in 1994. After the 2001 recession, when the economy wasn't doing so well, there were actually less than 6 million people receiving TANF. So the number of welfare recipients was just cut very substantially by the welfare reform bill. Now, these work requirements are controversial. I think it's an open question what society is going to do if and when a large number of kids, families with kids, hit the wall and they aren't eligible for government assistance. Some of the poor may need expensive services like daycare and transportation to make work possible, since their wages are not likely to be high. But it also seems like a culture of non-work had developed, and at least among some welfare recipients, and the work requirements helped to break up that culture. Yet another way to get around the poverty trap is to provide in-kind help. In-kind help meaning help not in the form of cash, but in the form of some service, like Medicaid, medical services for the poor, or food stamps that can be spent in groceries. But these still create issues of a negative income tax because they are phased out as income increases. The big idea of Medicaid and food stamps is that Medicaid, if you are a poor family with kids, and if you're eligible, then your medical bills are almost entirely paid by the state and federal government. The way food stamps works is you calculate what it would cost to buy the economy food budget. If it would be more than 30% of your income, you can get food stamps to pay for the rest. Food stamps is not really stamps anymore. Most of the time it's now a plastic card, but the name continues on. Those approaches are often politically popular because they seem to promise that the poor won't use the assistance unwisely. They have to spend it on medical care or food. But economists have pointed out that they have incentive issues too. For example, Medicaid can create a problem of what's sometimes called job lock, where you're worried about moving to a different job because you're worried about losing your Medicaid benefits. Maybe the insurance from the new employer wouldn't be as good as the Medicaid you're getting. Food stamps are also, for a lot of people, basically equal to income. I mean, after all, you can use the food stamps and that frees up money to spend on something else. Now, I've mentioned welfare, the TANF program, the Earned Income Tax Credit, Medicaid, and food stamps, but just to be clear, there's something like 80 other programs from the federal government where benefits are tested by income level. So those with lower income get the benefits, and they phase out over time, or they phase out as your income goes up. Some examples would be for supplemental security income. That's the part of the program that assures a basic minimum income for the elderly, but the issues of whether you expect the elderly to work are a little tricky. There are housing programs like housing vouchers or what's called Section 8. There's a federal child care program. There's the Head Start program some kids are eligible for. There are things in the tax code like a tax credit for children that phases out. There are things in the Bush tax cuts, various kinds of tax changes, that for those of us with several kids, that child tax credit has really made a big difference. There's school lunch programs. There's something called Women, Infant, and Children, the WIC program, which is food support for women who are pregnant or have babies or small kids. There's the low-income home energy assistance program to help with heating bills in the winter. And all of these programs create potential trade-offs between assistance and incentives. Now, some of them we don't worry too much about the trade-offs because programs aimed at the elderly or at kids may not have a big incentive on whether they work or not. We're not expecting retired people to work. We're not expecting kids to work. But we need to address this tension. We need to think about how it's always true. The issue isn't just how much money do you give people with low incomes, although that's obviously a big and important question. It's not just how much money do you give people, but it's how, as they earn more money, do you phase out that assistance? Because the way in which you phase out that assistance is going to be critical to the work incentives that you're providing and the incentives you're providing to help people get out of poverty and stay out of poverty. The more we think about that incentive problem, the more we think about how assistance is phased out, the more it will be true that we aren't just helping the poor, but we would be helping the poor to help themselves.